So welcome to Food Conversations Season 4, but before we begin, we acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepemec people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Now today I'm delighted to welcome back two guests who have been on our show several times and who have played an important role in the genesis of Food Conversations itself, and in addressing the issue of food sovereignty in the shoe swap. I'm speaking of Melanie Bennett and Serena Kaner, respectively Secretary and President of the Shoe Swap Food Action Society. It was actually a series of society public presentations entitled Food Conversations at Okanagan College, coordinated by Ron Burr and his wife, Shelley Corbin, both members of the Shoe Swap Food Action Society. That was the forerunner of this radio version of Food Conversations. It was Melanie who brought up the idea of a transition to the airways, and along with Serena, these two stalwart advocates have enthusiastically supported and facilitated that transition. As the radio version of Food Conversations moves through its fourth season on the air, our community owes a debt of gratitude to these two young women who continue working hard to advance the cause of food security and food sovereignty in this region. So Serena and Melanie, welcome back to Food Conversations.
Thank you.
What a nice introduction.
Yes. Well, we love coming to Food Conversations.
So an important reason for having you back on the show is that the organization you coordinate, the Shoe Swap Food Action Society, is very busy and is moving into new areas of community animation as well. And so it's important for listeners to hear what the society is up to. So that's what we're going to do today. And along the way, we're inevitably going to talk about the progressive and future-oriented principles that underlie the society's work and that resonate, in fact, with the community at large in so many ways. So let's start with a brief recap of the history of the Shoe Swap Food Action Society itself and how it operates. When did it begin?
2006, when there was an Eat Local campaign that was initiated. And that's where the logo that we've maintained comes from its original roots.
And that was the essential purpose, to encourage local eating locally, eating local food.
Yes, it was in and around the same time as the 100 Mile Diet. Kind of took over the airwaves, book waves. And the people who were really passionate here locally decided to do a similar challenge.
Now, today, the society is well established. How often do you meet, and in what fashion do you meet? Do you have board meetings, membership meetings? How do things work there?
Well, since we do have monthly board meetings, and we used to have community potlucks and membership meetings, and then when COVID happened, that kind of all disappeared, and we haven't really restarted that part of it. But we have had discussion of restarting it. It hasn't quite happened.
And roughly how many people would you say are official members or unofficial members or donors? Or it's always a bit of a tricky thing.
Yeah. We probably have about 500 members who are part of our newsletter. And I think we're growing. Like our numbers are going up, and I think our engagement's going up. But most people don't want to actually purchase the membership.
Yeah, it's all voluntary community-based organizations have the same issue. Is a donor a member, or is a member a donor, or please would you just give us some help in some way, any way you want to?
Exactly.
And what are your primary funding sources when it boils down to, you know, the nitty-gritty?
The community is our primary funder, actually. So if people stopped liking us, we would not exist. So we get grants, but mostly for specific programs. So grantors typically don't like to pay people or random things. They want a really specific project. So for example, our food box program, we got a government grant because that's emergency food aid, and that's something people like to fund. But for all our other things, a lot of it has been public donation and then grants.
And who are the primary grantors?
So the Government of Canada, I would say, is probably the largest.
We'll accept that.
And through it's not through the government of Canada, but like Community Food Center Canada. We're a member of the Community Food Center Canada, but it's essentially funded by the government. The Shoe Shop Community Foundation has given us money. We've had Fortius Foundation gave us money for our school meal programs, but Coldest Night is really our biggest fundraiser in the year, and we depend on Coldest Night to do our projects. And what we really appreciate about Coldest Night is that it allows us to do what's needed. You know, when you do a grant, you have to follow all these rules, and there's all this reporting, and there's all this,
yeah.
You know, and it wastes a lot of our time that we don't have. And so when you get money that doesn't have specific, like, for example, I had a school and they needed a fridge, and I'd be like, yeah, of course I'll buy a fridge, or, you know, and that's something I can do and I don't have to ask anyone's permission.
And I understand it also allowed you and Melanie to have a small stipend to just assist you in doing the amount of work you do, because you do a lot of work involved with the organization.
Yeah. So Melanie and I are both paid coordinators now, or I don't know if coordinator is the title. And then we also pay, we have, like, for our school meal programs, we pay all our cooks. So we actually, I have, you know, four different cooks right now that I pay. And they're funded through the sale of the food for the food. So the food's not free, but all the money goes to buying food and paying the cooks.
Just again, mention that I'm speaking with Serena Kaner and Melanie Bennett, who are the president and secretary of the Shoe Shop Food Action Society and have been guests on our show a number of times in the past and are always welcome. So how many active volunteers? I mean, every organization in this community sort of survives because there are people who come forward and commit themselves to being engaged. How many, you know, roughly speaking, how many active volunteers would you say you have?
25?
Yeah, between the community garden, which has its own sort of core group, and then the kitchen projects, which, you know, cooking and meal preps for those activities. Yeah. Between 20 and 25.
Yeah.
That's a decent number. And frankly, in a community this size, I mean, if you multiply to the size of Vancouver, you have a couple hundred. But I mean, for a community this size, that's actually pretty good, because I've been here a long time and I've watched organizations come and go. And if they all had 25 volunteers, they would be laughing.
Yeah, so, and our volunteers are really, like, we've had the same volunteers for a long time. So, one of the things we were really trying to do is cultivate a community amongst our volunteers, and we really appreciate our volunteers because we wouldn't be able to do half the things if without them. So, it's volunteerism is so important.
Absolutely, a central support. So let's begin by talking about something that's new that just happened this year and for the first time, and that is a whole series of educational and informative and inspirational presentations at the Fall Fair this year. Why don't you talk about that a little bit? I had the pleasure of doing one presentation, but there were many other presentations. There were an awful lot of presentations. What was that like?
It was really fun working with Jim. He's the Salmon Arm Fair coordinator, manager, and he's just so interested in, you know, building this community. And he's also, you know, really interested in agriculture. So it was fun working with him. You know, we were really happy that they asked us. And education is a big part of our mission. So not only are we trying to, you know, build capacity around local food, really encouraging people to eat local, but we really do want to educate too, because that's the long-term solution. So doing those urban agriculture talks, and then being supported by Buckerfields too, which, you know, they came from head office. They put a lot of work into it. They can watch the recordings now. They're on Buckerfields TV. And yeah, it was really important to have a great variety of talks, but it wasn't just, backyard chickens 101, for instance. It was like, what's happening in the community right now? Our very first talk had to do with boots on the ground, key leads in organizations telling the public exactly what is happening in our communities.
I listened to that presentation. I was quite surprised at the unanimity among the speakers. There were five speakers. they included people from a lot of different angles talking about food and food security. And they all said the same thing, which was essentially that there is a population in this community that is really very poorly served with respect to that kind of security, the food security, and that they all felt that something further needed to be done. Would that be the way you see it, Melanie?
Definitely. They were unanimous in saying that the time is now, not in 3 to 5 years. We need to look at the situation currently and come up with some solutions.
We'll be talking a little bit later about the city of Salmon Arm and its policy planning with respect to food. But how did Buckerfields and the Shuswap Food Action Society get together? Who spoke to who and got this show on the road, as it were?
Well, I would like to thank Toni Walton. She's the manager there at Buckerfields, and she's so passionate about what we're doing too. And she's been a great support. They have sponsored the garden. I think it came with Jim between, actually it was, her name is Sarah. She's with head office for Buckerfields. And then just the support of Toni Walton, the manager there at our local Buckerfields, that it all came together.
Where, by the way, is the head office of Buckerfields? I don't think it's just down the road, is it? It's somewhere distant from here?
No, it's on the island. It's in Duncan.
Okay. Well, she had to come across on the ferry. That was a commitment. So what was the range? You said there was more than just, just how-to presentations. There was also this initial presentation, and I would presume others that looked at the bigger picture. What were some of the key ones that you would say really exemplified what you were trying to do, this educational component?
Well, we sort of themed each day. And so the Friday, we kind of knew that typically it was actually a little bit more like seniors were going to be coming. And we wanted to potentially have people working like city council or people in agencies to be able to come during their workday to listen to some of these topics. And so that very first day was much more about what is happening with this food supply. Like, why are the prices rising? Like Brad DeMille was our second speaker, and he rushed over to, he's like, I don't know if I can talk for an hour. And of course he was able to. He did very well. And he was so engaging, and he just laid it out like, this is what's going on. And so between, listening to the heads of agency, between listening to him saying, this is what's happening with food. And then, we also had yourself talking about how is this affecting, our food sovereignty, where does that come into play? And we had people talking about pasture management. So we took food, local, the environment, how our food choices affect the world we're living in. And then we moved it right into the next day, which was much more empowering about what can you do? What garden can you grow? What's homesteading? I really loved Una St. Clair from Highcroft Farm. Her talk was so fun, and she's actually going to be speaking December 4th at our new Sunday sessions.
Lovely.
And then Sunday was very much about like those 101s, backyard chicken 101, seed saving 101. We talked about the 4-H, like how can we get people involved with 4-H? So we took it into a lot of different places, and just more like introductory, but just to really wrap people's minds around.
So overall, was the feedback you got about this series of presentations, Melanie, constructive, a positive? I mean, did you get people coming forward and saying, gee, I didn't know that, or I'm glad I came?
We did. We absolutely had positive feedback. It was really nice to have the recordings because, what we learned for next year is that we have to have a lot more advertising. We want way more people coming and sitting in those seats. And we also may have to change the location just because some of the sound. But, that was what we all really enjoyed about the whole process is you learn, you get better for next time. But that was the key there. It will happen next time.
It was certainly impressive to see how Buckerfields took this seriously in every way. Now, if people want to look at the videos, you said that they can see them on Buckerfield TV. Yes. You just Google Buckerfield TV.
It's their YouTube channel.
Okay.
So you can go to YouTube, Buckerfields TV, and they've got an entire series called the Urban Agriculture Series.
And what was the sound quality like? I know there was a lot of background noise. Is it decent? I mean, pretty easy to hear?
Some are better than others. It really depended on whether or not the speaker spoke into the microphone or not.
I have a feeling that I didn't always speak into the microphone, and I am going to pay for this in some form of penance at some time. Just again, mention that I'm speaking with Serena Kaner and Melanie Bennett, who are the president and secretary of the Shoshone Food Action Society and have been guests on our show a number of times in the past and are always welcome. Serena, let's talk a little about a program that's been up for a while, and that's the school food program, which is still flourishing and, you know, changing shape a little bit here and there. Where is the food program at right now?
Well, we've expanded quite a bit. So last year we were just doing it at Jackson. And so this year we're also at SMS at the middle school, and then we're at South Canoe Elementary. And then we're also making soup at the Zest Food Hub that we're delivering to schools to use for school meal programs. So if your school wants to run a hot lunch program, then you can order our soup and then we'll deliver it to your school with buns and fruit. And so we're doing that as well.
And South Canoe is where the outdoor learning program is taking place, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And they've always had a bit of a food culture at that school. So it was a really good fit. We've been doing, we've done a cooking program at that school before, and the principal is on board. So yeah, it was kind of a no-brainer.
And how many students are recipients of food or participants in the food, the school food program?
At which school, like total or at each school? Or
you can do either or both.
Well, at South Canoe, it's a universal program. So everyone, you know, you can order. We want everyone who can to order on pre-order and pay. But every kid gets offered the food, you know, regardless if they've paid or not. At Jackson and SMS, because they're such giant schools, you know, we don't have that capacity to serve every child. So we're serving between 80 and 100 right now.
That's a substantial number of people. And you said the cooks are remunerated?
Yes, yes. We believe it's, you know, I love with it, but they work with a volunteer. So the cook, it's a lot of responsibility cooking for 100 kids. And, you know, there's the grocery shopping and there's, you know, all this other responsibility. And, you know, from a safety perspective, you want someone with food safe, you want someone that you can trust. And when you're paying someone, they're more dependable, you know, they're less likely to have something come up that they can't come in.
Isn't that a remarkable fact?
Yeah.
A little bit of money makes the wheels go around. Who chooses the food? Chooses what will be on the menu?
Well, I came up with the initial menu, and then it's been guided a lot by students' feedback and by staff, and also just by equipment. So, like, the kitchen at Jackson is a lot larger. At SMS, we actually don't even have an oven. So we have to cook all in electric skillets and in instant pots. And so there are certain things you can't cook when you don't have an oven.
So there's a certain amount of creativity that goes into actually not only choosing the food, but finding out how you can prepare it, given each site's different capacities.
Yes.
And in keeping with the overall principle behind the Shuswap Food Action Society, is there an attempt to make sure that the food is locally sourced?
Yes. Now, the problem is that the kinds of foods that kids really want is often not locally available, such as like rice, for example.
Like Mars bars.
Well, we don't. Unfortunately, they have a dietitian leading it. So the Mars bars got left out. But
what a terrible tragedy.
I know. But we are, our meat is all locally. Our bread is all locally made. And then we actually got a farmer this year. We have a contract with Mara Valley Farm. It's an organic farm in Grinrod.
Indeed. Yes.
And so he delivers like onions, potatoes, carrots, cabbage, garlic.
Fabulous. I'm getting hungry.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, we still have to buy like I think my goal was 50% of our food to be locally produced. And I think we're right now we're over that because it's, you know, September, October, November. But once you get into like March, you know, it's slim pickings.
That's right. Indeed. For everybody, probably, when you want fresh local food. So let's shift gears a little bit into another new program. And that's also involves Buckerfields, at least their space. And that is an educational series upstairs in their meeting room. What's that all about? That sounds like an interesting new program. Melanie?
We didn't want to wait until next year, until the fall fair, to keep talking about the education. And the education actually this year did start in January when we started doing some gardening classes. So, you know, still during the tail end of the pandemic. And so we were still doing classes outside, but we did them. We did them at Pedro's. We did a class at Buckerfield's, all outside. And so that it started then. And now with Tony, again, being so supportive, they have this room that's perfect. It's upstairs. It has multimedia opportunities for doing presentations. And of course, the willingness. It's a free space, so we don't have to rent anything. And so it just was a really good continuation of the urban agriculture series at the fair, right into Sunday sessions for self-sufficiency. It's fun to say.
S-S-S-S.
And, you know, it's been really challenging to figure out what day and time is best for the most and majority of people. Mm-hmm. We've done lots of work bees at the garden on Saturday mornings. You know, you want to do it before. There's never the best time, but we figured that Sunday is usually a day that most people are available. Sunday afternoon means that they can go to church if they still want to. They can have their leisurely Sunday morning with their family. But we're, you know, yes, we're targeting moms. We're targeting the women in a household who could grow, raise, and make our own food and medicine. So we're happy to be able to do it. So far, the feedback is great. It's been fun trying to find the speakers and presenters. And so far, everybody is really interested in teaching.
Do you get the demographic that you're looking for? Do you get mums with small children, or is it their grandmothers who come out and say, I'm going to go home and talk to my daughter and see what we can do?
I think at the moment we're, you know, we're probably like, you know, 35 to 55 sort of demographic. Mainly, yes, women. We're not necessarily encouraging them to bring their kids. This is when moms can get away and have a little bit of time to themselves. And that's, you know, again, so Sunday afternoon, most probably can do that.
So let's move on to a program that's been established for quite a while. And this year is being extended a little bit longer, as it did last year also, than it usually would run. And that's the farmer's market. The farmer's market is really one of the avenues which local producers and growers can sell direct to their customers. And for them, it's a real advantage. There's no middle person who's, you know, facilitating the process for a small fee. Who wants to talk about that? Serena, is that high on your list of priorities?
It's high on my list of priorities. So this is our fourth season of our farmers market. And, you know, every year it's gotten a little bit bigger and a little bit better attended. And, you know, Salmon Arm, we've got quite a loyal following of shoppers. And it's, you know, small farms depend on farmers markets and local people supporting local farms. And you know, they don't produce the volume that's required to sell to a large retail store. So the farmers market is one way that they can make a living farming. And in our community, like we run the BC Fruit and Vegetable Coupon Program there, and that's a government program that gives low-income people farmers market dollars to spend on fruits, vegetables, or meat, eggs, and you know that program has really grown as well.
I remember going to one of the booths in the farmers market, and I was delighted to see that they'd sold everything out. They didn't have any more produce left on their counter. Are you finding that some of the participants, some of the vendors are having that kind of experience, that they bring a fair amount of stuff, and a lot of it, if not all of it, a lot of it goes, that they're really selling out?
Yeah, like I think the volume of food sold at our market is definitely increasing. We want them, I mean, a farmer wants to sell out every week. And that's sort of our long-term goal. We've lost a lot of farmers just from not being able to make it. But, you know, it's a really hard profession economically. And you know, the main problem, of course, being that there's no land that's affordable. So, you know, when a farmer leases land, the problem is if the land gets sold, then they lose their business. And they can't take the soil with them to a new farm. So
no, that's increasingly difficult, isn't it? But you must see some of the folks who are working out this new kind of arrangement where an older farmer or an old farming family no longer able to keep up the work of farming has engaged in a contract, typically through the young agrarians, to have young people who are keen, not necessarily related to the farming, to a farming background, but who are very keen on doing it right, have engaged in this kind of relationship where they do the farming on the land, and the farming family can sort of sit back and take a bit of retirement and maybe do a little mentoring, that kind of thing. Do you see that coming into some of the people that come to the farmers market?
At our market, we haven't had a lot of people who've used that model that have had success. I mean, we've lost farmers that way, where they did have a lease agreement and it didn't work out. I think it's a really great idea that in practice, I don't think works very well. Just because it's a relationship that's tricky because the landowner lives there and feels like they want things done their way. And farmers, especially vegetable farmers, in my experience, are, you know, you got to be pretty hardcore to be a farmer, and it's a business, right? And they want to do things, you know, what makes them money. And that's not always the most, you know, aesthetic or, you know, whatever. So I think it, and again, all their equity is going into the soils, and, you know, it's hard when you're building your equity in something you don't own. Because we've lost farmers this way. Was, you know, they get so discouraged when you've been building your soil for 3 years and then you have to leave, because you don't make money the first year you farm a new land, right? So you finally get to that point that you're making money, you know your soil, you know what grows well in this region, and then you have to move somewhere and learn that all again. So it's a really discouraging
process. Sounds like it's challenging. Just again, mention that I'm speaking with Serena Kaner and Melanie Bennett, who are the president and secretary of the Shuswap Food Action Society and have been guests on our show a number of times in the past and are always welcome. Well, let's turn to something that's been, well, before we leave the farmer's market, let's talk about super volunteer Howie. And board member.
Howie. We love Howie. Let's talk about Howie. No, Howie is, he was a gift. He dropped from heaven into our lives, and we just hope that he never leaves. Because you know what, he's the perfect. He's a really good compliment to me. His skill set is very different than mine, and he, what he was able to do is to pick up all the things that I was screwing up and doing a bad job of, and then do them well, and with a lot of modesty. And it's really helped our market.
So perhaps we can reveal for the first time to the universe on this program, Howie's last name.
McMillan.
Howie McMillan out there. I hope you're listening. And you realize that you have been considered a gift from heaven. Not many of us in this crowd will be considered that way. We hope we will be one day, but we're not sure if it's happening yet.
I do want to mention with him too, so he is very analytical, and this is what we really appreciate about him. He comes from 100 Mile House. I feel like I've gotten that wrong, but you know, he's been in this game for a while. He has been learning and educating himself about food policy for a really long time, and he's very passionate about the topic. So, you know, we have really good conversations about direction. He keeps, and like Serena's saying, like his skill set is very much like he's like a professional board member. Like he really knows how to do things properly. And he keeps coming up with new ideas. Like he is also not afraid to try new things. And so, like Serena mentioned, with the farmers market, we take on these BC nutrition coupons, but Howie on his own too has been continually trying to figure out how do we keep engaging people to eat local. So he actually started a Facebook page called Shushwap Locavore. And so he eats 70% of his diet is all local. It's just a nice simple diet that he has, but he really appreciates the quality. And so he developed the shoebox program. Like, he really loves people eating seasonally, and it just hasn't quite been taken off. But so he keeps trying these new different forms. And what we have now, thanks to Howie, is our own Food Action Society coupons. So whereas we have the coupons from the BC Farmers Market Association that is seasonal, it ends in December, we are now funding our own coupons. They're the shoebox food coupons. And these we're able to give to people that are referred to us, or with like Food with Friends, which is a volunteer initiative. Their volunteers are like of their own pockets, spending their own money to make potluck food items to share with members of the community. Well, we can give them these coupons that they can spend at our farmers market. So we are now funding that, again, based on our community who helps fund us. We can then provide these coupons to those who need. And this is kind of where Serena and I really, we care about. We don't want to be elitist. Like, food is a right for everyone, and everyone should be able to eat well. Food sovereignty, you care about that very much. And it's about having those choices, not just going to a food bank, standing in line and being given and told what you have to eat. So we are giving people the opportunity to attend the farmers market, which often, I mean, realistically, is a little bit more expensive for most people. So we can help them to be able to actually experience the farmers market, because it's such a fun place to be. And they also get to choose their own food. They're not being given a box. They can choose and use the coupons how they wish.
And how would an individual who was interested for one reason or other, maybe they wanted to share food coupons with somebody else, or they wanted to help somebody that they knew, or they wanted to use them for themselves, how would they obtain them?
Well, right now we're working through service organizations. So, you know, like Shuswap Immigration Services or the Family Center or Second Harvest. And so we're getting, and also the hospital. And so we're getting referrals through those means, because, you know, we're starting, this is a new program for us, and you know, that's sort of the easiest way for us to do it. But who knows what will be the future.
Right, exactly. Except that we know it's probably going to get warmer, and we're probably going to have more extreme weather events, and we better prepare for them or try to do something about making them not happen so often. Melanie, one service and entity that's really been a major part of the Food Action Society from the beginning is the Teaching Garden. How's the Teaching Garden doing now?
This year we grew twice as much food as we did last year. So last year we sort of tallied around 1,400 pounds of produce. This year, because of our mentorship from professional farmers, we actually have at least 2,500 pounds. Not all food was always tallied.
Okay, let's talk about the mentorship with local farmers. What does that mean? What has that meant, I should say?
We had Sue Moore, who came, and she actually did some teaching for us. And she's just lots of fun. We all get along really well. And she still, even though she sold her farm in Tappan, so she had Not Chill Organics and farm, she still has such a passion for it. And she still had seeds, and she sells her own food too, and she sells flowers. So she cares very much about good food going to people. And so this project was important to her to be able to keep growing this community garden and giving it in this altruistic manner. So she was instrumental. She grew seedlings for us. She would plant her professional seeds. And and she's fast. She just gets down in the dirt and she does it. But then we also had another gift from heaven come to us in the way of, her name is Elmarie Roberts, and she grew a market garden in Victoria at Halliburton Farms. And she's really passionate about permaculture. So Sue is organic, and she does things in a very sort of traditional way still, but Elmarie has this nuance to her where she likes to teach about permaculture, building soil, using the 12 different principles. And so she actually converted the back of the garden from a very ugly, scrubby mess with tarps and weeds. She converted it into a beautiful garden and grew a ton of extra produce that we wouldn't have ever had before.
What was grown in the magical back 40 of the community garden?
She grew like 80 extra tomato plants. She grew beautiful patty pan squash, and I'd never seen patty pans grow before. That was my first year this year. They're like little miniature squash. They're bumpy edges. They're magical. She grew lots of tomatoes, like I said, but then she also interplanted flowers, and she was very much about natural pest management. So she grew these Savoy cabbages that were perfect. She had lots of different flowers in between and calendulas and things that could help repel pests. And these Savoy cabbages didn't have any of the caterpillar holes that all of our other produce had.
Is that because of the companion plant? Was that the companion planting that did it, do you think? Or the flowers that repelled pests?
It's going to be that, but the main garden was the trap crop.
You sacrificed the main garden.
You know, I also want to thank Rotary, because of one of our absolute most phenomenal volunteers named Rita Greger. She's a Rotarian, and she brought Rotary to us, and they bought the garden professional pest netting this year too. So we're really excited to be able to use that more next year.
It's interesting how incrementally the garden has advanced. You know, people come along, they have new ideas, they have new or purchased technology that would be hard to just, you know, throw on a garden if you didn't have that sort of support from them. That must give you a sense of community engagement as a really important feature in what's going on.
We wanted to give, especially Sue and Elmarie, we wanted to give them a lot of ownership, a sense of ownership to what they were doing. It was important. And we all learn from each other. I love the most about that garden and also the food forest is when you're working together, you inevitably talk about food. We talk about the crops that we're growing and we talk about what we can make with it. And we share recipes and we talk about the world. Yes. But we always tend to talk about gardening again, and we learn a lot from each other.
It's hard not to see this as anything other than the exemplification of acting locally and thinking globally. I mean, it's things grow everywhere, but how you grow them has a huge impact on what goes on in the rest of the world as well. It's a delightful, practical expression of all the things that we think are important in the world these days. Let's divert a little bit to the entity that is the biggest source of funding for you, which is the event called the Coldest Night of the Year, CNOY, for those who are in the inner track. Who wants to give me a little idea about the Coldest Night of the Year and what's happening this coming year? Because there's going to be another event in the dead of winter. When's that going to be?
So this year it's Saturday, February 25th. It's almost always at the end of February because that is traditionally supposed to be when the coldest night is. This year, you know, again, if people hadn't heard of it, it came to us at just the right time. You know, during COVID, when no event could exist, here came an event where people could participate because it was outdoors and walking. And again, I think I want to just reiterate what I love about this and about our organization is that we want to make sure that everyone can be involved. And I love this event because anyone can participate. You don't have to have a whole bunch of money. You don't have to have anything. You can walk for free if you want to. You don't have to fundraise. I mean, that's what it is. It is a fundraiser that ends in an event, but you don't have to. And it's about building community. It's a healthy activity, and you can try and earn that beautiful toque. And this year's toque is really nice. Like, you'll want it.
I already have one. Is it better than the one I have already?
It's black. Well,
and I heard the bowl of soup at the end is actually worth walking for.
I would not argue with that. The bowl, I actually had, I think, three bowls of soup. I fought my way through the crowds to get an extra bowl or two. It was very yummy indeed. Is the relationship with the people who organize, who originate the idea of Coldest Night of the Year, is that that seems to be developing into an ongoing relationship? Like this is not the first year it's happened, and it seems to be established as an ongoing relationship.
It's a huge event. I mean, this is it's across Canada. It's in 126 different cities, and it's actually now moved into the States. So it's a really, really big event. And the foundation that owns this event, who basically gives it to us like a gift, you know, it's got a really well-created website. You can, all of your fundraising can go through it. It's like really streamlined. And so for an organization like us, again, we don't have a ton of active participants. Having a fundraiser is actually a ton of work. It usually costs you a lot of money to do everything up front. It takes many, many months of planning to do a big event in the hopes that you'll sell enough tickets and recuperate most of your costs. Whereas this here, I mean, it takes us time, yes, but we don't have upfront costs. So, you know, sometimes people will make comments maybe about how, though some of the money does go to the foundation, Blue Sea Foundation, it is a tremendous asset to us as an organization, this fundraiser.
Let's pick up on that, because earlier in the show, we mentioned about policy and planning and the support from the community, and especially the community governance system. Perhaps I remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Melanie Bennett and Serena Kaner from the Shuswap Food Action Society. Serena, maybe you can talk a little bit about what the city is doing or is not doing to facilitate the development of the programs that are central to the Food Action Society, and what your thoughts are on that matter. Because just for listeners to know, instead of it being an immediate priority for the city, it is now being relegated to being a medium-term priority, which means it's something to be addressed in the next 3 to 5 years. Okay, Madam President, fire away.
You're talking about the food and egg strategy.
Yeah, indeed.
So everybody, I think, right now is worried about food. You know, I think the romaine, a head of romaine hit $7.50 in some stores today. And you know, that's just not affordable for most people. And there, this is a number of things contributing to this. You know, the rising costs of fuel, you know, the lack of shipping containers, with everyone ordering everything else online, it's hard for produce, you know. Then there's all the paperwork and that, you know, when you're crossing borders. So any climate report you read recommends that, you know, having a localized food system is a great strategy for climate.
A robust local food system.
Yeah. And we've seen that, right? So when the highway closed, you know, we couldn't get milk. So we've seen all the warning signs. There's nothing in any forecast that I have seen saying this is going to get better. Everything's saying it's going to get worse.
And I can corroborate that from my study of the IPCC's reports and the work that the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment has been doing. There's no question about it.
There's no question. And so I guess we've been wanting the city to create a strategy for a long time. And you know, one of the problems in food everywhere is that it's no one's job. Food security is nobody's job. So there's no food security person that works for the city of Salmon Arm or for a school district or whatever. So it's laid on the hands of charities, and we have such limited capacity because we, you know, we don't have paid staff unless we raise money.
Serena, you said that there's nobody doing this job. I want to pick up on that because in a sense, what you're saying is that we just haven't realized that we have to eat and we need to have somebody making sure that that happens. And yet everybody knows that we have to eat. It's not a secret. I often tell my patients it's a problem. You're addicted to food. You have to eat it every day. And I am too. So it's a universal phenomenon. How do you think we got to the point in our world that we didn't take food all that seriously?
Well, I think it's just we've taken it for granted for so long. And because we haven't had to be, I think, you know, with the Green Revolution and industrialization of farming, we don't see, like, it, I mean, we do in Salmon Arm, but outside of Salmon Arm, in the cities, people don't see where food comes from. They have no idea. And they've just always gone to the grocery store and seen it. And, you know, I lived 6 months in Malawi, and where people only ate what they grew in their yard, right? And when I came back to Canada, I actually had, you know, that culture shock where I went to a grocery store and I actually felt nauseated because I'm like, where did all this food come from? Because no one in the store has any idea, you know, that most people in the world, first of all, have not a clue, like a fraction of the selection, but also like they actually have to work to make that food happen. Whereas we don't have to do anything, that we just have to go to the store. So I think because we don't have to grow our own food, we don't appreciate how difficult it is. And I think anyone, I mean, I really admire Melanie and her passion for gardening, because when I also have a garden, but when I garden, I'm like, I just thank the farmers. I'm just like, oh man, I am so glad that I can spend my money on farming, on a farmer growing my food, so that I don't have to do it myself. Because it's hard. It's every day. And like, once you've worked all day in a farm, you don't want to process it and freeze it. Like, I totally understand where, you know, our food system came from. But with that loss, you know, people don't get it.
So I would deduce from what you've just said and from what we said earlier, that having a really organized focus on developing the food system, whether you call it having a policy or whether you just say we're going to do something, is something that we haven't been doing and that we probably need to do, and we need to do it on a fairly urgent basis.
Yes. Like, and I made a list for council of the farms that we've lost in the last 4 years, and I think it was 10. And those are farmers that have moved to other provinces, who've left the profession, and they're not being replaced. So there's not a lot of intake. I mean, 4-H is an important intake for farmers, but, you know, most schools don't teach farming or gardening, or so I don't know where people think these farmers are going to come from. Are they going to drop down like Howie from heaven? We hope so.
We're looking up every day to see what's coming in.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, we're in trouble. There's no question we're in trouble. And that's why we need to start talking about this, because problems don't go away when you ignore them.
Just again, mention that I'm speaking with Serena Kaner and Melanie Bennett, who are the president and secretary of the Shoshone Food Action Society and have been guests on our show a number of times in the past and are always welcome. We're going to be coming to the end of the show shortly, but I want to give both of you a chance to talk about what you see coming down the pike, what kind of future plans you have, whether they're actualized or just in the back of your mind. Melanie, where do you see things going with respect to food in the Shuswap and in this community? Or what do you want to do about it?
I want to remind everybody that we can do things about it. And so we live in this amazing place that has beautiful seasons, and we've got water and we've got good soil, and that we can do a lot about it. So, like, I know that we just said the forecast looks really dire, but we are actually in very good circumstances, and we have to take advantage of that. So to squander it would actually be the tragedy in this. So what do I personally want to see? And again, this is why, you know, the organization that we have is so diverse, and we've got lots of different ways that people can get involved and help. We can teach, because these skills, like Serena says, where does this food come from? Where did it come from? Well, we can learn about it. So we can learn about how food is grown, and we can learn to do it again, and we can teach kids. And we want to focus on kids, because honestly, they are the ones at this point who will probably ask and demand more from their parents. Parents are overwhelmed at the moment. And so it's very easy to just sort of like zone out, buy some takeout, it's way easier. So the kids need to demand more. We want to see people growing their own food. And those are some of the projects that we will work on as well.
Well, I encourage everybody who is a child listening to this show to start taking your parents to task. But before we do that, Serena, do you have any, we're just about at the end of the show, but do you have any final thoughts about what you see we need to do and what you would like us to do in this community and region?
Well, you know, I think one thing is we need to start looking at farmers as a really important resource. That is a skilled job, like an engineer. They should be paid like engineers or like doctors, because it's a lot of work. And we've got some tremendous farmers. And the thing is farmers don't just grow your food, but they also contribute a lot to the community. So like one of our farmers, she's one of our volunteer drivers, and she drives our soup out to Falkland for us. You know, that saves me an hour and a half. And, you know, that's Chelsea Keenan. And, you know, we have like our, you know, Mark, a farmer who we're buying our products from, you know, he delivers it to the school. You know, it's just, there's so much value added. And like the other day, I'll just tell one final story is I got a call at 7:30 in the morning from the pack, one of the pack presidents from Hillcrest. And she's like, Serena, we're having a hot lunch day today with your soup. And I forgot to tell you. So it's like 7:30 a.m. and I have to suddenly come up with soup for a whole school. And you know what? So I call up Marcus from Inspire Brand. I'm like, Marcus, I need these buns. Can I get them for you today? And he's like, oh, we have no problem. And, you know, then I called the Pearson's Orchard and I'm like, I need some apples. Can I get, oh, yeah, no problem. You know, and like everyone is so resilient and flexible and adaptive. You know, if I called Cisco at 7:30 in the morning and was like, can you change my delivery to, you know what I mean?
No, they'd say no.
They'd laugh, right? So This is, you know, this work is relationship work. And you know, I think strong relationships build strong communities.
I think that's a wonderful point to end on, because it really is the essence of living in a smaller, in a rural community. And it's something that probably people around the world really want to start rebuilding, is relationships and the connection to the people, the connection between the people who eat the food and the people who grow the food, so that they understand each other and they realize that they're interdependent. They're no longer sort of operating in a vacuum. And that I think is a very sound point for us to close on. Thank you both, Melanie Bennett, Secretary of the Shishwa Food Action Society, and Serena Kaner, who is the president of the very same organization. Thank you both for coming on the show again, and thank you for your ongoing support of Food Conversations and the food community in this town and in this region. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.